This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israel is rejecting accusations by the UN after UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet said Thursday that Israel's deadly strikes on Gaza may constitute war crimes and that Hamas, Islamist group, had also violated international humanitarian law by firing rockets into Israel. Bachelet said that her office had verified the deaths of 270 Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, including 68 children, during violence this month. Most were killed in Hamas-controlled Gaza, where Israel fought militants for 11 days, ending in a ceasefire. Hamas rockets had killed 10 Israelis and residents. Bachelet was addressing a special session of the UN Human Rights Council held at the request of Muslim states who had asked for the forum to set up a commission of inquiry to investigate possible crimes and establish command responsibility. A reaction from China, as U.S. President Joe Biden ordered a new review of intelligence into the origins of COVID-19. China says the U.S. has no interest in conducting a scientific study of the origins of COVID-19 and is attempting to politicize the investigation as the World Health Organization prepares to begin a second phase of studies into the origins. China has been under pressure to give investigators more access amid allegations that SARS-CoV-2 leaked from a laboratory specializing in coronavirus research in the city of Wuhan. China has repeatedly denied the lab was responsible, saying the United States and other countries were trying to distract from their own failures to contain the virus. This is VOA News. The head of NATO says the government and armed forces of Afghanistan are strong enough to stand on their own feet without international troops to back them. At some stage, it has to be the Afghans that take full responsibility for peace and stability in their own country. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told the Associated Press in an interview Thursday, NATO took charge of security efforts in Afghanistan in 2003, 2 years after U.S.-led coalition ousted the Taliban. The military alliance is scheduled to leave by September 11th. Many officials have expressed concern that once the U.S. leaves, the Afghan government and its armed forces will be quickly overrun by the Taliban. Thousands of people scrambled to flee the Congolese city of Goma Thursday, some picking their way across landscapes scarred with lava after officials said a second volcanic eruption could happen at any time. Magma, the molten rock that normally stays beneath the Earth's crust, had been detected beneath the city and adjoining lake. The 31 people were killed Saturday evening when Mount Nyiragongo, one of the world's most active volcanoes, sent a wall of orange lava downhill toward the city, destroying 17 villages along the way. The Washington State Attorney General in the U.S. has charged two Tacoma police officers with murder and another with manslaughter in the death of Manuel Ellis, a black man who died after telling them he could not breathe as he was being restrained. The Attorney General Bob Ferguson filed charges of second-degree murder Thursday against Christopher Burbank and Matthew Collins and first-degree manslaughter against Timothy Rankine. Witnesses reported seeing Burbank and Collins, who are both white, attack Ellis. The 33-year-old was killed March 3, 2020, just weeks before George Floyd's death triggered a nationwide reckoning on race and policing. Ellis's final words, "I can't breathe, sir," were captured by a home security camera. French President Emmanuel Macron said that he recognized his country's role in Rwanda's genocide and hoped for forgiveness at a memorial on Thursday, seeking to reset relations after years of Rwandan accusations that France was complicit in the 1994 atrocities. This follows the release in March of a report by a French inquiry panel that said a colonial attitude had blinded French officials and the government bore a serious and overwhelming responsibility for not foreseeing the slaughter. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 28th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. French President Macron seeks to normalize relations with Rwanda.
Speaking the truth is risky, but you do it because it is right. Even when it costs you something, even when it is unpopular.
Civil society groups condemned Mali's military leader for declaring himself president. Uganda sees a sharp rise in COVID-19 cases. Kenya's gender-based violence cases rise fivefold during COVID-19 pandemic. And Somalis agreed to hold long-delayed elections in 60 days.
I think it happened because I think the prime minister has shown leadership. He has shown that he's a consensus builder by reaching out to all the critical actors. I think that was the difference.
And the tobacco giant's Burkina Faso distributor denies smuggling and funding terrorism. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Emmanuel Macron continues his two-day working visit to Rwanda today, Friday, aimed at mending over 27 years of strained relations between the two countries. As Eugene Uwimana reports from Kigali, President Macron expressed remorse on Thursday for France's role in the 1994 Rwanda genocide.
For many Rwandans, it was a special moment to see a French president touching down in their country and laying a wreath as a respect to the victims of the atrocious genocide perpetrated against the Tutsis in 1994. For the first time, President Macron officially acknowledged the role France played. As I stand with humility and respect at your side on this day, I come to recognize the magnitude of our responsibilities. The French president said only genocide survivors can forgive France.
Ce parcours de reconnaissance.
This journey of recognition through our deeds and our donations offers us a hope to come out of this night and walk together again. On this path, only those who have gone through the night can perhaps forgive. Make us the gift of forgiving us. Rwandan President Paul Kagame thanked President Macron for his willingness to mend relations between the two countries. He described the French president's acknowledgement of his country's role in the genocide as heroic.
Speaking the truth is risky, but you do it because it is right. Even when it costs you something, even when it is unpopular. Despite some loud noises and voices, President Macron took this step. Politically and morally, this was an act of tremendous courage.
The Rwanda government has been accusing France of playing an active role in the genocide because of France's close relations with the regime of then-President Juvenal Habyarimana. To make matters worse, a French judge accused top Rwanda officials of shooting down President Habyarimana's plane. President Kagame's government has denied the allegations. President Macron is expected to name a new French ambassador to Rwanda. The previous one left Kigali in 2015.
In Mali, opposition and civil society groups are condemning former military junta leader Colonel Assimi Goïta for declaring himself interim president on Thursday. The groups say the move sharply undermines the process to return Mali to constitutional rule. This comes after former transitional president Ba Ndaw and former prime minister Mokhtar Bouane were released from military detention on Thursday. The prime minister had been accused of carrying out a cabinet reshuffle without consulting interim leader Colonel Goïta. For the latest political development, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Alfusini Sadibi, a 2016 Mandela Washington Foundation fellow in the Malian capital, Bamako.
So withdrawing this assistance to Mali is going to touch not only the military aspect, but also the social aspect of social life of Mali citizens. So this is very, very important, this assistance to Mali militaries. Removing it is going to be very, very tough on the ground.
Now, Sadibi, the statement said that any civilian or military leadership seen as impeding the process of transition to democratic rule could also be sanctioned, or measures could be taken against that individual. How significant a statement is this?
Taking these kind of measures, which has objective to help the transition process, anything today that can help really Mali going out of this crisis is welcome. So we appreciate any kind of help or any kind of actions that can help Mali get out of this transition period, so that we can have free and fair election with through which we will get an elected president, which who will then work to tackle the different aspects of life, so that Mali can get out of this hard period that we have been through since 2012.
The head of the former military junta, Colonel Assimi Goïta, has declared himself the country's transitional president after stripping the country's interim president and former prime minister of their powers. Some people are saying Malians are displeased with this latest development. They think it might somewhat impede the progress or transition to a democratic or elections. How are Malians reacting to this?
We have different views about it, because when you read people on social media, some are very upset about the situation. Some also are favorable of it. So the situation, which is really embarrassing to all of us, because he's kind of cool in another coup, and declaring himself as a president. And I think they suppress the position of vice president right now. We are observing, I'm reading people on social media, and many of whom are really not happy about the situation. If you read on social media today, political parties are condemning it. Some social leaders or influencers, they are also condemning it. But some other citizens are for this situation. So we would now wish that this happened. We had already the date for different elections, so we need to come back to normal so that we can go for this election.
Alfu Sinit Sadibi is a 2016 Mandela Washington Foundation Fellow in the Malian capital, Bamako. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. A Somali member of parliament is praising Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein for his leadership and consensus-building skills that led to an agreement this week to hold Somalia's long-delayed elections in 60 days. Abdi Razak Omar Mohamed, also a former Somali security minister, says unlike President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed Farmajo, Prime Minister Hussein was successful in negotiating a deal because he has no intention of running for the presidency.
I think this is a very positive agreement, and I hope that indeed the nation to go to the polls. I think it happened because I think the Prime Minister has shown leadership. He has shown that he's a consensus builder by reaching out to all the political actors. I think that was the difference. You know that a few weeks ago we were on the brink of armed conflict in the city of Mogadishu. I think this agreement has changed that trajectory. And this agreement is going to lead the nation to go for the parliamentary election as well as the presidential election.
So what does that mean for President Farmajo? Does he continue as president?
Well, the president's term has expired on February 8, 2021. He might stay as a caretaker president, but when it comes to the management of the election, the security election, those two issues are very important, and they will be managed by the Prime Minister and the federal member states.
Would this election be a one-person, one-vote, or is still following the traditional Somali election?
Yeah, it will be an indirect election. That is why the time to hold the election is within 60 days. Otherwise, a direct universal suffrage election requires much, much more time to implement. So we will be going to the indirect election this time. the polling stations will be protected by the Amazon police as well as the federal police and the federal member state police. So it will be managed.
How come Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein was able to pull this out and President Farmajo was not able to?
It's very important to point out that the electoral impasse was the making of the president whose term has expired, who was looking for a term extension. On the other hand, the prime minister succeeded where the president had failed because the prime minister is not a presidential contender, so he doesn't have stakes on the outcome of the election. So he was able to reach out to everyone, compromise, and come up with this wonderful agreement that the election should be held within 60 days.
Thank you always for your insight.
Thank you, James. Thank you very much.
Abdi Razak Omar Mohammed is a Somali member of parliament and a former security minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mogadishu. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 28. Kenya's Department of Gender says reported cases of gender-based violence have nearly risen fivefold during the COVID-19 pandemic. But activists say stigma and fear of reporting abuses means the real number of cases is many times higher. Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi.
Jacqueline Karemi recalls the day in April when her partner of nearly a decade suddenly accused her of having an affair and attacked her. She says, we wrestled. He was trying to strangle me and pull me back to the bedroom so he could lock the door. But I managed to get out of the room. He wanted to push me off the fifth floor. I hit him. Then he started slashing my face and head with a Maasai sword. Karemi's was among more than 5,000 reported cases of gender-based violence in Kenya over the past year as emotional and work stress mounted during the COVID-19 pandemic. That's nearly five times the number of reported cases in 2019, according to an April survey by Kenya's Department of Gender. But Kenya's women's rights campaigners say the majority of cases go unreported. Vivian Mwende is a counsel at the Federation of Women Lawyers Kenya.
Reporting will either cause shame, I'll fight with my parents. Another thing could be that nobody will believe me because this person is a reputable, could be a chief, could be anybody. So this person is reputable in this area. So a lot of trust has been lacked, especially with the reporting system, because people really, most of the victims believe they are not going to be heard.
To encourage gender-based violence survivors to speak out, Kenya's women's rights defenders hold open forums. The convener of one such forum, Rachel Mwikali, of the Grassroots Human Rights Defenders, explains why.
The reason why we're having this fellowship is to try to bring more women human rights defenders and activists and feminists that are able to talk against any form of violence against women and girls and any form of violence when it comes to human rights violation.
Kenyan authorities are running a campaign called Komesha Dhulma, meaning stop violence in Swahili. The goal is to motivate the public to report cases of gender-based violence. An official at the Department of Gender, Beatrice Elachi, is leading the campaign.
For us to achieve, even to start talking about it, to make it open, for people to come out, for women to come out, we have to have a holistic approach on how do we indeed deal with gender-based violence. Dealing with it is not taking people to court alone or fighting it the way we want to fight it. We have to go back even with the church, because all of these people are people who are in, who go to church, some of them who go to the mosque.
As COVID-19 continues to take its toll on families, gender-based violence survivors like Karemi can only hope more people speak out against what many now call a pandemic within a pandemic. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Uganda is seeing a sharp rise in COVID-19 cases, forcing its health officials to take stern emergency measures. From 200 cases per day in April, the East African country is now recording over 1,000 cases per day amid a looming vaccine shortage. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
To the Ministry of Health, hundreds of people line up standing, others sitting as the line snakes its way to the vaccination tent. Uganda's COVID-19 cases stand at 44,594, with 361 deaths. Dr. Jonas Tegen-Waldemariam, the country's representative at the World Health Organization, spells out the rate at which the coronavirus is spreading in Uganda.
On the week starting from 25 April, Uganda reported 256 cases. The week starting a 2nd May, that number went up to 411. The week of the 9th of May, the number went to 475. And the week of the 16th May, the number has already reached 1,060.
Kampala is among 10 districts that have recorded a high number of cases. Odoipo, 39 years old, is among the many who thronged to the Ministry of Health on Thursday to get their first jab.
To make sure that I'm free from COVID-19, like in India, people are dying in the USA, like that's why I say let me also go and save my life before that such thing happens in our country.
Dr. Henry Mwevesa, the Director of Health Services, notes that it has taken the country less than 10 days to get to a full-blown pandemic. The most affected group is people between the ages of 20 and 39, and the number of severely and critically ill COVID-19 patients is higher than it was in the first wave. Dr. Mwebesa says officials are making tough decisions to ensure that people in densely populated areas such as Kampala get the vaccine.
We also note with concern that some districts, especially in the east and northern regions, have not performed as well. So the strategic committee meeting of the Ministry of Health resolved that vaccines be withdrawn from the poorly performing districts to avoid wastage and also expiry, and that the exercise should commence 27th May, which is today.
In March, Uganda received 964,000 doses of COVID-19 vaccine from the COVAX facility, with 100,000 doses coming from India. Since March 10, about 550,000 people have been vaccinated with the AstraZeneca vaccine. A second batch of vaccines was expected starting this month, but Dr. Waldemariam says that is not guaranteed.
The supply we were expecting in May hasn't come, and it's unlikely to come in June. So we are working towards seeing where we can get an alternative supply other than India. Globally, now there is a big effort for big countries which have excess vaccines to donate. So we are looking into whether we will benefit from that.
To show the full extent of the second wave, tonight, the three major local television stations in Uganda will anchor a joint news bulletin under the theme, Act or Perish. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Two investigative reports this year accused the Burkina Faso representative of tobacco giant Philip Morris of funding terrorism through tobacco smuggling. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Apollinia Campari rejects those findings. Henry Wilkins has the story from Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou.
Selling cigarettes to smugglers who pay jihadists to protect their convoys. That's the accusation levelled against the Burkina Faso representative of Philip Morris International by the Organised Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, OCCRP. In a February report, the Sarajevo-based group cited officials, rivals and former colleagues of Apollinaire Compaoré who accused him of indirectly funding terrorism by working with smugglers who carry not only cigarettes but drugs and people into Mali, Niger, Nigeria and Libya. It also accused Burkina Faso authorities and the Swiss American tobacco giant of being complicit in a vast smuggling operation centered around a warehouse in the northern town of Markoi.
Indeed, we think Philip Morris was aware of what he was doing. There's also clear indications that parts of the Burkina Bay state, including customs, were involved in the warehouse at Markoi. In fact, the customs officer we interviewed characterized it as a mafia at the top of the state.
Burkina Faso's customs department was not available to comment on the accusations against the agency or against Compaoré, who also owns a major bank and telecoms company. In a written response, Philip Morris said there is no evidence of wrongdoing by the company and no information indicating their products shipped to Burkina Faso were smuggled into neighbouring countries. But a 2019 UN report also found that a company owned by Compaoré supplied regional smugglers, says one of the report's authors.
He knowingly supplies those that traffic, and he must be aware of this because there's no legal market for those cigarettes once He brings it to northern Burkina Faso.
In an exclusive interview for VOA, Compaoré refuted all these accusations. He says the United Nations lied and that those who worked on the report for the UN are no longer employed by them. One of the richest men in Burkina Faso, Compaoré also dismissed claims in the OCCRP report that two of his companies have never paid taxes. Are they the Director General of Taxes, he asked. He said they are all lying to harm him. They're lies, he insisted. When asked if there is any evidence of Compaoré being involved in cigarette smuggling, Mamouni Lougé, the general manager of Burkina Faso's tax department, cited confidentiality laws. What is known, he said, is that the tax administration is very vigorous, and does not in any case let this type of fact pass it by without it going unpunished. Whether or not authorities take action, the allegations that cigarette smuggling supports Sahel terrorism is not expected to go away anytime soon. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the Total CAF Super Cup. Egyptian giant Al Hakli faced Morocco's RS Berkane on Friday at the Jassim bin Hamad Stadium in Doha, Qatar, to determine the winner of the 29th edition of the Total CAF Super Cup. Al Hakli holds the record for the most number of Total CAF Super Cup titles, having won 6 times out of the 8 finals it has played, the last of which was the 2014 edition at the expense of Tunisia's CS Faxien. RS Berkane has never won the Total CAF Super Cup, with this week's clash against Al Hakli being their first in the tournament, having won their first ever African title in the Total CAF Confederations Cup in its last edition. The Super Cup is determined between the holders of the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederations Cup. Juan Pedro Benali is the coach of RS Berkane. He says he will respect Al Hakli, but says there is no place for fear.
You know, it's a final. It would be between two big teams. Al Ahly, we know very well, that's champion, one of the biggest champions of Africa. But a game is a game. We'd be 11, be 11. And we are really waiting for the time to start tomorrow.
Pitso Mesumane, Al Hakli coach, says every match comes with its pressure, but insists Al Hakli is always expected to win.
We respect them. They're a big team. It's a cup final. It's a 50-50 situation on the cup final. Yeah, they've got good players that score goals. Aziz scores goals. They've got Nasheed who scores goals also. And good centre-backs. Dayo and Traore with the midfielder. Very good team.
And now to athletics, where the first squad of athletes to represent Team South Africa at the Tokyo Olympics has been announced, with just 56 days to go before the games get underway in Japan. Notable omissions from the squad include the likes of Wayne Van Niekerk, Caster Semenya and Jordy Smith in athletics and surfing respectively, but they will have time to qualify, and the expectations are that they will and therefore be added to the final list for Tokyo. At a virtual announcement on Thursday, representatives are across 7 codes were named. These include athletics, climbing, cycling, gymnastics, hockey for men and women, sailing and surfing. In basketball news, the Tigres of Nigeria will be in action this weekend as arrangements have been concluded for 3 Grade A friendlies with 2020 Olympic-bound teams as the teams step up their preparations for the games. The coach Otis Hugley side, who camping in Las Vegas on the 8th of May, left for Belgium earlier this week, where they will face Belgium, Puerto Rico and Serbia. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, May 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.